Now, Aidan McCarthy was a modest Cork man who spent his early life in Castletown Bear. After graduating from medicine at UCC, he went to England, where he joined the RAF. Now, his life then took a series of incredible twists and turns. It's all documented in a book called A Doctor's Sword, How an Irish Doctor Survived War, Captivity and the Atomic Bomb. The book's author is Bob Jackson, and he's with me now in studio. Bob, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Pat. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Aidan McCarthy, how did you come across him first?
I first came across the story, and I was thinking about it earlier. It's almost 20 years ago since I first came across the story. I was working in a bar in Cork, and one of the customers gave me a kind of a loose outline of what he had experienced. And
it's the kind of story you wouldn't believe, actually. It's so far-fetched, you would not believe it.
Exactly. So I had an idea that I'd like to find out a little bit more. But the same person mentioned that Aidan McCarthy had a connection to Aidan McCarthy's bar in Castletown Bear. So I ended up in Castletown Bear and I saw the name above the establishment. I went in, I asked the lady behind the counter, I said, look, I heard this story, and I gave my description, and I asked her, was I in the right place? She said I was, and she pointed to a newspaper article on the wall. Yeah.
There was a great book written by the late Pete McCarthy, McCarthy's
That's right.
Bar.
Yeah, and
that
was one of the bars. In the same
Absolutely.
Bar. So it's an iconic institution at this stage, really.
Now, Dr. Aidan McCarthy actually wrote a memoir.
He did, yeah. That was first published in 1979. It's called A Doctor's War. And it's an absolutely incredible book, but it's very short. It's only about 158 pages.
It's kind of just the narrative, the bare narrative.
Yeah, he's very, very light on detail. It's incredibly well written, but for example, he describes the atomic bomb and the aftermath and everything he witnessed in 4 pages, just over 1,000 words.
Just give me the facts.
Exactly. And it's like what he says is fascinating and, you know, harrowing. But at the same time, there's so much detail that, you know, through his nature, really so understated, and he wasn't really trying to blow his own trumpet.
Now, you did a documentary on Dr. Aidan McCarthy, and you wanted the memoir to be republished, but the publisher had a different idea.
Yeah, that was about 2 years ago. I contacted Collins Press about, I had an idea that they would reprint Aidan's book to coincide with the cinema release of the film. So I met with Con Collins and I told him what we had been working on for the previous couple of years. And I left him with about 9 gigabytes of images and folders and documents.
Which, of course, did not feature at all in the original work.
Exactly, because a lot of this turned up. There was an incredible cache of documents which Nicola McCarthy found while we were making the documentary. And they were original documents that Aidan had gathered up while he was in the camps. When I met Con Collins, I told him the updated version of the story and how we found the family of the Japanese officer that gave Aidan the sword. Con Collins listened to it, and 2 days later he ran back and he said, look, this is a new story completely. Would
All
I be
right.
interested?
Now, you've teased people with a number of references there to the camps and to the Japanese commander who gave him the sword, which gives us the title of the book,
yeah.
A Doctor's Sword. But before he got to the dropping of the atomic bomb, I mean, he had so many adventures en route. When he graduated from UCC, I mean, there were people who wanted to get involved in the war effort. Could have been the army, could have been the navy, could have been the RAF.
Mm-hmm.
Why the RAF?
He met with two students that he had studied with in UCC, and they went out on a night out on the town in Soho in London, just as war was breaking out. And the discussion turned to joining the war. They were all young men. They were looking for adventure, in his own words. And they narrowed it down to the navy or the RAF. And they couldn't decide between the two. So they asked a barmaid to toss a coin, and the coin came down on the side of the RAF.
And had the coin landed another way, it would have been a completely different story.
Exactly.
Now, what you did in writing the book, because you already had done the documentary, but it's one thing to make a programme, it's another thing to write a book, and you know, you've backed up everything that you've written with all sorts of documentations, and apropos of our earlier discussion, lots of citations and all the rest of it. But your technique for kind of putting his story in the context of the world was very interesting.
I think the first thing that I had to do when I was asked to write the book was to really, really research the events of the time and try to understand from his perspective what was going on in the world and what would he have been learning about in real time. So I spent the first number of months researching in detail all of the events of the war. And I came up with an approach, which was that I had three parallel stories or that I was focusing on. One was the events in the wider war, so major events like
Stalingrad, Pearl Harbor or whatever.
Exactly. The other timeline was his own personal experience and what was going on with his family back home, whether someone got married or ordained and, you know, significant events in the family.
And of course, there would have been letters that would have linked what he was experiencing, also how he was affected by the greater world as he heard that someone was getting married, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it humanized the account in a very real way.
And a number of very interesting kind of coincidences emerged from that as well. And in telling the story then, for example, when he was being transported to mainland Japan, where he spent the final year of the war as a slave for the Mitsubishi Corporation. But as he was being transported to Japan, D-Day was happening on the other side of the world. So it was like the war was coming to an end in one sense on the other side of the world, but his experience were just about to get even more hellish. So I think putting together the timeline and seeing where all those intersections took place made it for me, it definitely gave a very useful perspective on what was going on in his life and the life of his family.
Now, for the young pilots, let's go back to the beginning of his experience in the RAF and the number of sorties they did and how likely they were to return from those sorties. The odds weren't great.
No, it was horrific. First of all, their average age was 22 in bomber command. I think it was even younger in fighter command. They would have been like the Spitfires, etc. But in bomber command, one tour would have been 30 missions. And they had a 30% chance of surviving a tour.
So one in three would come home after the end of a tour.
Yeah, yeah.
And then if you went on a second tour?
They had a 10% chance of surviving. And a lot of people did volunteer for a second tour.
Extraordinary.
And they would have faced flak guns over Europe, enemy fighters, engine failure. You know.
Now, he witnessed Dunkirk.
He did. And I suppose the interesting thing really is that in his experience, Dunkirk is just like the beginning of his story. It's like the prologue to his story.
Yeah.
You know, the Chris Nolan film's coming out next week. And that in itself, like his experiences in Dunkirk are worthy of a film or a book in and of themselves. But he was very lucky to escape. He spent the 3 days and two nights on the beaches in Dunkirk in a foxhole. And he was very lucky to escape. The ship that they boarded eventually was torpedoed by a German submarine or a plane. He never found out which, but the ship was torpedoed, and the captain of this ship was previously a Larned Stranraer ferry. The captain ordered everybody over to one side of the ship, so it tilted the ship, and they managed to
get home.
Barely
get home. It was the first of many misadventures that befell him. He ended up heading out for the Far East, and the war was obviously going apace there. He was captured.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was captured in March 1942, and he spent the next 3.5 years as a prisoner of the Japanese.
He managed to survive using all sorts of confections, knowing with doctorly skills what might be nourishing.
Yeah. One interesting example is that he used the maggots, which were in the rice that they were given dirty rice. So in a lot of cases, there would have been a lot of maggots. So while they were cooking it, the maggots would have risen to the top. So they collected those and they created a maggot soup, which they gave
which
to
had
the
protein
sick
in it.
Exactly. Yeah, because their diet, that what they were given, they were barely given any food. I mean, they were starving to death, basically. So he was able to improvise with very limited resources, and he saved a huge number of lives. He was awarded an OBE in 1948 for his work in the camps then.
Now, he was transported towards the Japanese mainland, but even that was not without incident.
Yeah. The journey itself took five weeks to get from Java to Japan. And they endured numerous air attacks and submarine attacks. The Americans at the time had the upper hand in the Sea of Japan and in Southeast Asia. But they were just about 40 miles from Nagasaki when the transport ship, which he and 780 other prisoners had been crammed onto, was torpedoed by an American submarine. And the submarine, torpedo hit the front of the ship, which was travelling at full speed. So it sank in something like 2 to 3 minutes. But he was very lucky to escape that. And the reason he escaped is because a rat had got stuck in his mosquito netting, which was wrapped around his feet because the ship was infested with rats. So he was sitting up, whereas the other prisoners were asleep. And when the torpedo hit, the reverberation of the explosion through the metal decks caused the other prisoners to either get concussed or their necks were broken, he presumed, in a lot of cases. But he was sitting up, so he managed to escape.
Now, he escapes and ends up working for Mitsubishi Steel in Nagasaki.
Yeah.
As a slave worker, basically.
That's right.
And he's there when the bomb drops.
Exactly.
I mean, it's Forrest Gump. It's,
yeah.
It's quite extraordinary. And yet, he's in a shelter and emerges to find out what the Americans have done.
Yeah. Yeah. Initially, they had no idea what had happened. They were less than a mile from the epicenter of the atomic bomb. So when they came out of the ground, whereas they were previously in the industrial valley of Nagasaki, which, you know, was, as far as I could see, it was factories and like all of that was wiped off the map. They came up out of the ground, and he described it that there was concrete tennis courts where factories had been. So all of the walls, all the structure of the building was erased, but the floor, the concrete floor, was still there. So initially they thought the world had come to an end, and then black rain started falling. So that kind of confirmed their biblical notions about what had happened. And that went on for a while. His initial response then, incredibly, was to help Japanese civilians.
The title of the book... and it's called A Doctor's Sword. Tell us why that is the title of the book.
And about just a week, just less than a week after the atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, Aidan and the other prisoners had been moved to another prisoner of war camp when the surrender was announced. And immediately after that, a lot of the prisoners tried to take revenge on their former camp commandant. So as they were trying to hang him, apparently, Aidan McCarthy stepped in and he saved the Japanese officer's life. And in gratitude, then, the Japanese officer gave Aidan his ancestral family sword and a photograph, interestingly enough, which had a big part to play in the documentary and the story. And this was absolutely unheard of, that a Japanese officer would gift a sword to their enemy. So... eventually then, Aidan made it home. By the time he arrived back in Dunleary in November 1945, he was half his body weight and he had the samurai sword, which he kept then for the rest of his life. And interestingly, he also kept the photograph. So that would indicate that there was some genuine, or you would assume that there was some genuine kind of respect or admiration between the two of them.
And of course, the family were tracked down, and that's another story. The book is called A Doctor's Sword, How an Irish Doctor Survived War, Captivity and the Atomic Bomb, published by Collins Press, and is available in all good bookshops. Now, Bob's going to be reading from the book at the Literary Festival in Bantry next Tuesday. That's the 18th of July. And then on the 20th of July, you're heading off for an RAF hospital.
That's right.
What's happening there?
The RAF have built a new hospital at RAF Honington, which is where he rescued the crew of the bomber that crash landed. And next Thursday, Prince Harry will be opening, officially naming this building in honour of Aidan McCarthy. So
my goodness.
Adrienne and Nicola McCarthy and myself, we're heading over and we'll be guests of honour. So it's going to be very exciting.
Well, what a fantastic story. Just one text here on this. My dad got sent the book from a man he met on holiday after telling me about it. It's been read by 5 people since. All have read it in one sitting. I just called my dad to get him to tune in. Well, you'd prefer each bought the book, I'm sure, rather than spread it around. But it shows what a great book it is.
That's great to hear.
A Doctor's Sword, it's called. And thank you very much, Bob, for coming in and talking to us. Author Bob Jackson.